Academic freedom is largely designed to protect faculty members' rights to say what they want to say without fear that the university will sanction them or punish them, that speak without reprisals. It's designed to protect the freedom to say what you want to say, but it doesn't always protect you from consequences for what you say. You know, let's use a very stark example. If you're speaking in public or in publications, on tweets, on the radio like we are now, about areas in which you teach and do research, then you can be held responsible for those. Let's say that you're an engineer, and there happens to be one at Northwestern, just a little north of us, who regularly denies that the Holocaust existed. It didn't happen. He says it's a fake. He's protected when he says that because he's an engineer and because he can build bridges whether or not he thinks the Holocaust is a fake. But if an historian at the University of Illinois were to say that the Holocaust was a fake, that historian could be sanctioned for it because that would prove that the historian was incompetent. So in terms of the Salida case, there are really two issues. One is a very technical issue. Was he an employee of the university, and did the university owe him academic freedom protections? Academic freedom gives him the right to say whatever he wants, but if he's not an employee, it can have consequences, which is what happened in this particular search. Some people say, well, he'd received a job offer. It hadn't been approved by the Board of Trustees, but that meant he's sort of the moral equivalent of an employee. I think that argument has some merit. I happen to disagree with it. And the things he said in public were very much in the areas in which he does research. The conflict between Israel and the Arab states and peoples is the most common theme of everything that he's written. There's nothing more central to his scholarship and his intellectual life than that. And so his social media comments were in exactly that area.
So given what you've said, if we had a situation where Stephen Salida or someone in that situation was clearly a tenured professor and made remarks with that sort of controversy, are there protections or not?
If he were a tenured professor, he would be fully protected. We only can raise those questions for a tenured professor if the remarks he makes suggest or demonstrate that he's incompetent, but not if they're outrageous, not if they're racist, if they're anti-Semitic. As a tenured professor, he can say those things and he's fully protected. But as a job candidate, if he's not yet a faculty member here, then we can take those things into consideration when we decide whether or not to actually hire him.
Meanwhile, the status of Stephen Salida's appointment at the time that he issued the tweets about Israel, he said that he may take this to court. If a court were to rule his way, or if any agreement happened which put Stephen Salida on the faculty as originally appointed, does that set a precedent that affects university governance, and in what way?
Well, a jury is reluctant to award tenure. Courts are reluctant to award it. And in reality, I don't think Stephen Salida's statements in the public domain would play well with a jury. You put 50 of his tweets in front of a jury, and the jury's not going to like him. So he could use a court proceeding to raise the size of a counteroffer. I don't think he can get his tenured job in court.
Well, that raises questions with me, at least, about the appointment procedure at the University of Illinois, where commonly the final appointment doesn't come until after the professor has already started teaching and doing work at the university. Is that common at universities around the country?
It's not unheard of, but it's completely unacceptable. I think the procedures are flawed at the University of Illinois. I actually think that they're ridiculous and outrageous, and that the Board of Trustees has to act on appointments months before the person is supposed to arrive. My guess? I think at this point, the board is going to be willing to change its procedures and make certain that they act in February rather than in September. How does that affect this case? In my view, that gives the university not a legal responsibility to do something for Stephen Salida, but a moral responsibility to do something for him. I think he deserves a serious financial settlement, $1 million, $2 million, something quite substantial in exchange for that tenured position.
And in the future, if changes in appointment procedure are made, and let's say the Board of Trustees approves a faculty appointment in February, and then in June that appointee does something outrageous or controversial, is that appointee protected or not, since they will not start work until August?
He's protected because he has a legally binding contract. Now, if he robs a bank or if he shoots his mother-in-law, he's not protected because then he's vulnerable to state action in the courts. But he's protected from university action if he has a legally binding contract. I think February is about the right time to process those appointments. The board can really change that procedure. If that had happened in this case, Stephen Zelida would be a faculty member here.
The next controversy concerning academic freedom is likely to be under different circumstances than the Zelida case, but do you see any broad lessons from this case that might be applied in the future?
I do. First of all, I think the process of reviewing his work was less than thorough. I've read 3 of his 6 books. I'm now on the 4th, and I've found what I feel are lots of problems in Stephen Zelida's books. The main problem is factual errors. The second problem is treating an opinion about an historical event as if the opinion were a fact, not an opinion. I think there needs to be more substantive review at the college level and at the campus level at the provost's office. So I think that's a lesson to be learned. The other lesson is, when people at the upper level have problems, they should consult back with the department. They have a power to get more outside letter evaluations. They have a right to reach outside the university and ask people at other institutions specific questions about the candidate's work. I just think that the whole procedure in this case was less than thorough.